Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The View from Here on KGVM 95.9 FM in Bozeman, serving southwest Montana. I'm Jeff Milchin, your host, and I'm excited to welcome today from Livingston, Montana, George Werthner. George is the author of more than 30 books on natural history and other environmental topics, including Wildfire, A Century of Failed Forest Policy, and Energy, Overdevelopment and the Delusion of Endless Growth. He's a regular writer for Counterpunch, Wildlife News, and amongst many other publications, and also is a professional photographer and guide. We're going to focus largely on a topic of great interest to much of the country this year, wildfire ecology and public lands. Welcome, George.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
All right, so we're recording the day after Labor Day, and the smoke was so bad in Bozeman yesterday that people were advised to breathe outside with a mask on, COVID issues aside. So it's obviously a hot topic and a timely one for the moment for us to learn more about why this is happening. So I was wondering, George, first, could you give us a kind of a historical perspective of how this fire season compares to others in our history, major burns in the past couple of centuries? And if the Western drought continues, will, as most climate scientists seem to think, is this going to become the new norm, or will there be a leveling off, or will this be kind of a periodic thing rather than an everyday expectation of what life is like in summer here?
Well, you just gave me a big, long line of questions, but let me start with, when you look at past climate conditions, there is a correlation between drought and warmer temperatures over the centuries and for, you know, literally for millions of years. We can document that you get vegetation burning under certain conditions, and under other conditions, like the last ice age, when it was wet and cool, you have less burning. And in between the last ice age and today, we've had periodic warm spells. There was an episode between about 800 AD and about 1300 AD called the Medieval Warm Spell, where the temperatures were, in some cases, warmer than even today. And I won't go into all the reasons why that occurred, but we have these periodic warm periods in the past. Now, I hasten to add, the warm period we're experiencing now is not natural, even though some people want to say that. There's a direct correlation with the CO2 levels in the air that are traceable to human activities, like burning fossil fuels, etc. And we have known since the 1800s that CO2 will trap heat. So that's beyond dispute. And we have more CO2, so we're having heat trapped. And as a result, we're seeing more and more wildfires and larger wildfires. And if you go back just even the last century, 1900 through about 2000, we can see the ebb and flow of fires during that period, again, correlated with the climate. So the early part of the last century, despite all this stuff about 100 years of fire suppression, we had huge fires. The big burn that burned western Montana and northern Idaho would burn anywhere between 3 to 3.5 million acres. And there's no fire we've had in recent times that big.
And that was 1910?
1910, yeah. And then through that whole period, 1900 to about the end of the 1930s, it was, you know, we had the Dust Bowl. You know, we had major droughts around the West. And in 1929, it's estimated that up to 50 million acres burned. 50 million acres. Today, if 10 million acres burn, we call that a record year. So a lot of what we are hearing in terms of rhetoric about fires being worse than ever, it's a shifting baseline. They start with the 1970s, which was a cooler and moister time, and there were not many fires. And then it gradually got drier and warmer. And particularly starting in 1988 with Yellowstone, we've seen larger and larger fires. Now, let me step back and use Yellowstone as an example. back in the 1970s, which, again, it was a cooler and moister time across the West in general. In fact, I can remember hearing back in the 70s about fears that we're going into another ice age. Okay, so the climate was cooler and moister, and there was fears of how we're going to feed ourselves if the glaciers come south again. And so Yellowstone decided to try something. They they decided not to suppress fires in the backcountry. And they had 235 fires between 1972 and 1987. So it's a 15-year period. And during that time, they had 225 of those 235 fires that burned less than 5 acres with no suppression. The point being, most fires go out if you do nothing because the conditions aren't suitable for them to spread. Right. And even the ones that were a little bigger never got really huge. And then, and this is where it's important to the rhetoric about fuel buildup, 1988 comes along, and you have 500,000 acres burn in Yellowstone. There was not suddenly more fuel in 1988 than 1987 when they were letting fires go and nothing was happening, or 86 and 85 and so forth. So what that shows is that that year, 88, was the driest recorded in Yellowstone history since they started keeping records there in 1872. And the internal moisture of the trees there got down to 1 to 2%, and kiln-dried lumber is like 12 to 15%. In other words, the trees, the green trees themselves, were more flammable than the lumber you get from the lumberyard. And another important point, and this gets to some of the other rhetoric you hear, is that, you know, mostly what burned in Yellowstone in 88 were green trees, not dead trees. And the reason green trees burn well is they have all this fine fuel. That's what burns in a forest fire, is the needles, the cones, the small branches, the grass on the ground, the shrubs. And that is why you have snags left after a fire, because the big trees don't burn. Which is, you know, I'll circle around. I hope we'll talk about this more. But one of the solutions right now is if we only go and thin the forest, and when they're doing thinning, they're taking the big trees. They're not getting rid of the fine fuels necessarily, and so they're not removing what will burn. And when the trees are green, they actually burn better than a dead tree. And this is another one of those fables out there or whatever. The reason being is that the green trees still have all the needles and fine fuels, and they have flammable resins in their needles and branches. Whereas once a fire or beetles or whatever kills a tree and the needles fall off, that's a qualifier. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that happens pretty quickly. Then those snags are not that flammable. And we all kind of know this intuitively. If you've ever had a campfire and you put a big log on it, if you just try to, well, you can't light a big log, and then you got to have lots of few, you know, smaller stuff underneath it as kindling to keep the log burning. And it will, you know, once the sort of the coals go die out, the big log, you see it all the time on campfires, a big log across, you know, the rocks around that people have made the fire ring. So big trees will burn, but they don't burn readily. And often it's just the outer bark and stuff that's burning. So we've had these, now we have incredible droughts happening. Some of them saying, like in California, there hasn't been a drought like they're having in the last 5 or 10 years. They had a few wet years in there. But in general, it's drier now there than it's been in 1,000 years. Do you think that might have something to do with the fact that they're getting big fires? I think it does. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of evidence that that's what controls the large fires. And the counterpoint to that, I would tell people to think about, is if you go to something like the coast of Washington, the Olympic Peninsula, which is the rainiest, coolest place on the West mm-hmm. Coast, there's nothing burning there right now, even in drought years, because it takes a lot to dry out that right. vegetation. So that, again, even though there's more biomass, more fuel in the Olympic Peninsula, you know, largest trees and so forth, all sorts of dead stuff on the ground piled 10 feet high, and it's not burning. So
when people focus on an individual drought year, you're saying that's just one factor, but what's gone on in the previous several years is probably at least as great a factor as what goes on in that individual year.
Exactly, because it takes a while for the soil moisture to recover from a drought year, and therefore the vegetation too. And so what you have is a continuous drought, and you might have a few wet years in there that mitigate that particular summer. And if it is wet that summer, you will probably have less fires, because right. when it's wet, like was it last year? I think it was so rainy and everything here, and it was green mm-hmm. to the end of July on right. the hills. There were virtually no fires around here.
Right.
And then you get a drier year, and then there's lots of fires. And then there's happenstance. you still have to have a source of ignition, mm-hmm. and you have to have the right conditions. And now let me talk about those right conditions.
Absolutely.
Because what you find is that every large fire, and I've gone around the West, one of the things I try to do is go look at the circumstances behind how fires burned and what the topography, the conditions were, the vegetation, and so forth. And there's a consistent pattern, which is if you have drought, that has to be a baseline, drought, along with high temperatures, low humidity, and the most important thing is wind, then you have fires that are unstoppable. And it's a very small percentage of fires. We get this idea that every fire is happening, but it's almost like Yellowstone in the sense that even now with drought, the majority of fires don't burn more than an acre. You know, lightning strikes a tree, that tree goes up in flames, and nothing happens. But if you have wind in particular, you know, I've seen the media has finally caught on to this. I've seen more and more reports where they say, well, the firefighters got the fire under control because the wind died down, or the fire is raging because the wind is blowing. And the reason why that works that way is wind affects fire exponentially. It's not a linear relationship. So a 20-mile-an-hour wind is not like doubling the spread of the fire.
It's
from a 10-mile-an-hour wind, yeah. It is quadrupling or more. So imagine when you get these winds of 50, 60 miles an hour, what that's like. And what it does is not only like us blowing on a campfire, it puts embers in the air. And those embers can travel miles ahead of a fire front. And that has a number of effects on fire. One, firefighters won't get in front of a fire that's got wind behind it. So there's nothing to stop the advance of the fire unless they get way out in front,
right,
and they can predict that the fire's going to go there. Then they might build fire lines, you know, 10 miles out or something, but they're not going to be right there at the fire's edge. Second, it's difficult for aircraft to fly under high wind conditions, so you're not getting slurry bombers and helicopters dropping water to the degree that does any good anyway, but you're not getting that. And then the third thing with that kind of a fire blowing embers ahead is even if you built a fire line, or in the case of other solutions people propose like thinning the forest, the fire is just going to jump over that stuff. If it doesn't burn through it, it'll go right over it or around it or whatever. So you cannot really stop the fires when the wind is blowing, basically. And I saw a similar thing. I wrote this book about Yellowstone fires years ago, and I was researching about past fires in Yellowstone, and there was a comic thing. I was in the research library there at the park and reading old historical references to fire. And there was one fire in the 1930s, and this ranger on a typewritten page, you know, I'm reading through, it says, well, we finally got the fire under control, but had a hell of a time breaking camp in the rain. And it's sort of like, it's almost like he said that in the same sentence, like he didn't see there was a connection, you know. And that is usually what happens. I have, and this is another important thing, I have this fire that I was able to get the hour by hour, day by day changes in the wind and temperature and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it was a fire outside of Boulder, Colorado. And I also got pictures of how the fire burned. The fire burned through thinned forests and didn't burn the stuff that hadn't been treated on the sides of the thinning. And the wind was blowing it through that. And then it finally, the fire stopped, also in a thinned area. So some people are saying, well, look, at thinning worked. But if you look at the hour-by-hour stuff, at the start of the fire, the wind was blowing 44 miles an hour, and the humidity was 4%. And then when they claimed that the thinning worked, which, you know, prior to that it had not, when they claimed the thinning had worked, the humidity was 100%, i.e. it was raining, and the wind had died down to like 1 or 2%, you know,
right,
mile per hour.
So, George, we spend, you know, I don't know how many billions of dollars on fire suppression on public lands in,
right,
in the United States. Are you saying most of that is not well spent, that we should primarily be having the firefighters wait for the opportunity created by nature and then just make sure everything is out rather than actively fighting a growing fire?
If you talk to a lot of firefighters, they would say, we know when it's effective to attack the fire.
Mm-hmm.
But if we sat around camp playing cards, everybody would be irate. So we have to put on the air show or they the firefighting show to make it, you know, and there's a chance occasionally that they actually can, you know, the just as they're getting there, the wind might be dying down just enough that, that their efforts are effective.
Right.
But a lot of them will tell you, you know, they're standing around watching the fire, and they can kind of maybe guide it along the edges, which can be important,
right.
You know, if it if they can push it away from a town or something.
Sure.
But for the most part, they'll tell you it's too risky to try to get in front of any fire like that. And mm-hmm. and we know when the conditions change. Like Yellowstone is, again, I use that all the time. I was there all summer long watching the fires, and they had 10,000 firefighters, which is more than any fire that I know of any place this summer. And it had no effect until September 11th when the snow came.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, if it were back in the 1930s, they'd say, well, you know, finally got the fire under control and had a hell of a time breaking camp in the snowfall. You know?
Right.
So,
George, one thing I find absent from most media coverage of forest fires is any discussion of what type of forest it is, what elevations are in play. Can you give us a sense of, you know, amongst our different forests, and speaking at least to start in the western United States, how does it differ as you go up in elevation and forest type? And if you're talking about, say, a Doug fir forest and the western slope of the Cascades, how different is that from a lodgepole forest in Montana?
That's an excellent question. What you hear in firefighting community and from politicians and so forth is that we've had this fire suppression that allow fuel buildup. But and they said fires used to be very frequent every, you know, 5 to 10 years, and that kept the fuel from accumulating. Well, that's only true and only partially true for basically pine forests. And if you get into any other plant community in the West, the fire rotation, in other words, the time between major fires when most of the acreage burns up, is often in hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an important point that even a lot of fire ecologists don't get, which is if, for example, the fire rotation in a particular vegetation type, like lodgepole pine in a lot of places has got 200, 300-year fire rotation, it doesn't mean that at 100 years, half of that area should have burned. It's more like, think about it like 100-year floods on a river. It's not like half of, at 50 right. years, you should have had a flood half the size of the 100-year flood or something. And the other thing, using rivers as an example, you can have a 100-year flood 1 year, and the very next year have another 100-year flood. It's about the magnitude mm-hmm. of the flood. And fires are like that. And most of the vegetation communities in the West actually have long fire rotations, where to the degree that I throw a bone to those that fuels are building, fuels build, but it's natural. In other words, in a lodgepole pine forest, it just doesn't burn most years for a long time because you have to have the right conditions for a fire. They used to talk about the Yellowstone forests. You know, it's a high plateau where it's snowy 9 months of the year and cool. That they were the, quote, asbestos forests. That's what they thought until 1988.
Right.
And but the point of that is you could have gone out in Yellowstone in, say, 1979 with a flamethrower and probably wouldn't have gotten a fire to go anywhere
mm-hmm.
Because you didn't have the right conditions for the fire to ignite and spread. And in most of the plant communities around the West, aspen, sagebrush, juniper, subalpine fir, lodgepole pine forest, all these forest types around here actually have much longer fire rotations. And the indication of that is we have evolutionary evidence. For example, sagebrush, I'll use that example. There's 16 species of sagebrush in the West, and only one of them sprouts from its roots. So all the other sagebrush have to come back from seeding. So in order to sort of restore to their previous level of sagebrush density takes a long, long time. And if they were being burned every 5 years, they would have adapted something to allow them to deal with that. The fact that right. they don't have that ecological adaptation is evidence that they didn't burn that frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And another example would be subalpine fir. Subalpine fir has very thin bark. It It doesn't, and it's got branches all the way to the ground. It's got everything perfect to burn under the right conditions, but it doesn't burn very often because the right conditions don't happen. So, but this whole idea that fires were frequent and kept fuels down has been widely disseminated, and it really, you know, it was an improvement. When I first started school, I had a professor who was really into fire ecology, and I took, he was a botany professor. I took three classes from him, but every one of the classes was basically fire ecology, because that was his main emphasis. But at that time, it was, they were trying to change the whole idea that not all fires were bad. And so the idea was, oh, frequent fires are good because they keep the fuels burning. And that mindset is now widely accepted, which is good. But it's now been generalized to all vegetation types. And that's been a mistake in the thinking. So a lot of these plant communities don't tolerate frequent fire. But when they do burn, they often have what's called a high severity fire. Now, I should explain that. Low severity means the majority of vegetation, like trees, we'll use trees, don't die. And then a mixed severity, which is anywhere between 25 to 75% of the trees might die. And then high severity is where you get a higher mortality. And in any large fire, if you look around the West, like let's say 100,000 acres burn, you will find that the majority of acreage burned is at low severity. And then the high severity patches are usually the least abundant in a fire. You know, maybe out of 100,000 acres, 20,000 acres burn in high severity. And that's the other thing, is that these fires burn in mosaics for a lot of reasons, like the weather. You know, a gust of wind comes along and that pushes it through and you get a high mortality patch. And then the wind dies down, and then it kind of creeps along for a little bit, and then it gets another gust of wind, or maybe it's heading downhill. Downhill, things don't burn as well as uphill, because preheating from the flames means they burn at a higher severity going uphill. So there are a lot of variables that will affect that, and you get this mosaic as a result.
So just to clarify for folks, when you talk about a mosaic, you mean on a day when the conditions might be relatively damp and wind-free, the fire will keep progressing through a patch of forest, but burn a lot less overall of the biomass than on a day when the humidity is low and the wind is
exactly
raging, so you get a very different effect from the same fire.
Exactly. So that over the period that a fire is burning, like the Dixie Fire that's burning down in California now, it's almost 1 million acres, I read this morning. And I'm sure if we go there, I'm going to go there this fall to check it out, you'll find many patches that are, you know, lightly burned, mixed in with much more heavily burned patches. And that is the typical situation with most fires. And in fact, my theory on fire stuff is that, you know, that it was actually the big fires burning under better fire burning conditions or extreme fire weather that created a lot of the low severity burns around the West. And this gets to other solutions like prescribed burning. You're not going to set a fire, if you're a smart fire manager, under extreme fire conditions. Right. So most prescribed burning doesn't really burn that much. And they have a difficult time getting it to, you know, I mean, it's sort of like a drop in the bucket. It's like you're, you know, trying to fill a swimming pool using coffee cups or something like that. You're just not going to have that much difference. And so that is a, quote, a solution across the landscape is probably a great exaggeration. Now, some of those things, whether it's thinning or prescribed burning, some, if it were done right immediately around communities and buildings, could be just the added bit of help that firefighters could use. So I'm not saying that you wouldn't want to do that at no place, but you want to be very focused where you do it, and not just across the landscape, because you can't catch up. This is another thing with the you have to keep in mind with both prescribed burning and thinning suggestions, is that opens up the forest and reduces competition. So in the short run, it may reduce fuels, but a lot of times you get more biomass of the wrong kind. In other words, more fine fuel growing there. Shrubs, small trees, grass, than you had before you treated it. So that's another limitation on the value of prescribed fires and so forth and thinning, because if you want it to be effective, you've got to retreat over and over right. and over forever. And so what I see with the agencies is they're out 30, 40 miles from town, some town doing a thinning operation or a prescribed burn operation. And they might have done one next to town 10 years ago, but they haven't gone back and done anything about it.
Right.
So
question for you regarding the thinning. Can a forest thinning project done for, you know, genuine forest health improvement, wildfire reduction risk, be commercially viable? Or does that need to be done by our public lands officials? You know, maybe they're selling the timber, but not having a for-profit timber company come in and do the cutting. Or can it be done that way?
Very unlikely in most cases. And in fact, that's one of the problems with thinning around the West right now, is that they throw in the big trees, which are the very trees you should be leaving behind to make it economical. And I have to hasten to say that there's no standardized prescription for thinning. So, you know, I'm generalizing here, and there are some kinds of thinning that's better than others. You know, like if you wanted to go in and hand cut the smallest trees out, that might help a little bit. If you were to do it without putting in logging roads, that's better. The best prescription is to do two burnings after you've thinned, because thinning actually puts a lot of fuel on the ground, which helps the fire spread. So, but, you know, that's actually not done very often. And in general, and again, I'm generalizing, that the thinning operations often make things worse. And as an example, I told you about the fire by Boulder Canyon. It did not burn in the areas that weren't treated along the treated areas. The treated areas burned, but the untreated did not. And there are studies that show two things. One, that there's higher severity burns in places that are, quote, active management, which encompasses everything from clear cutting to prescribed burning, then in places like parks and wilderness, which have presumably more biomass.
So let me ask you specifically, if you have familiarity with these projects, sure. I'm sorry to put you on the spot.
Yeah.
Not, are you familiar with what's going on in the central and northern Bridgers right now?
Yes.
Logging up there. Tell us, you know, well, if you've evaluated that from a perspective of, is it really helping the forest or not?
Okay, there's a couple of issues there. The Forest Service back in the late 80s, early 1990s was so aggressive about logging. They had what they call a clear-cutting rider and so forth in right. Oregon and all this stuff. And that the social license for logging was eliminated. So the Forest Service had to come up with another rationale for logging. And the rationale now is fire prevention and forest health. And that's what they're using in the Bridgers.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to address the forest health first, because that shows, to my mind, ecological ignorance in many ways. For one thing, things like bark beetles, wildfires, and so forth create a habitat, snag forest, that's actually rare on the landscape. And there are many, many species of wildlife and plant life that depend on those snag forests and the aftermath of a fire or bark beetle. In fact, there are studies that show up to 50%, for example, I know one study was done here in Montana a long time ago, but that suggests that 50% of the bird species were dependent on the aftermath of a high-severity fire. And then you have things like 40% of the mushroom species found in Montana come in after a high-severity fire. There are more bees in the forest after native bees after a high-severity fire. There is more fish in the stream after a high-severity fire. There and bigger fish. So you go through all these different life forms and you find that many of them prefer or are almost obligate to having those fires and dead trees. And so the idea that we're going to make the forest healthier by trying to prevent those things from happening is just as ignoring that whole ecological requirement for those trees. And the trees are not just There's also structure. In other words, the snags are a structure, and then they fall on the ground, and they provide structure on the ground. You know, maybe voles hide under it, and marten climb on the tops of it. I mean, there's all kinds of ways wildlife use those dead down trees. And they're also, and this is more important today, they are big carbon storages. Even though there is carbon given off when a forest burns, there's more carbon stored on site in a burnt forest than after you log it or thin it. Mm-hmm. And so thinning and logging actually releases more CO2. In Oregon, now Oregon gets a lot more logging than around here, so I got to say that at first, but 35% of the CO2 annually comes from logging. It's more than all the transportation, all the cars, the jet planes, and everything in Oregon is less CO2 contributor than the logging. And so that's the CO2 that's released, plus you're losing the storage factor. You know, a dead tree will gradually rot and give off CO2, but the issue we have is we need to try to reduce that now. Right. And if it takes 100 years for that tree to rot, yeah, it's going to be giving off CO2 all the way for 100 years, but that's a much more gradual input.
Right.
And there's even studies that show that between after a fire or a bark beetle, you get all this new growth. So you have new trees that are grabbing CO2 out of the atmosphere, plus you have the old stuff that's still storing it. So collectively together, they actually might have more CO2 storage and uptake than if you log it by far. So that's an important thing. So when they say forest health, they're ignoring.
He's skeptical.
Yeah, it's misleading. It's very misleading. And then right. And then you have the residual other effects. It's like logging roads are a big source of sedimentation and weed invasion. You know, you get the weeds established in the midst of a forest, you never get rid of them. And there's access, to the degree that people will drive ATVs or even hike on those logging roads. You know, I hike on logging roads, too. It's easier sure. than not. And, we have an impact on the wildlife there. So the greater the road network, even, quote, temporary roads, just because they block off with a gate doesn't mean somebody isn't walking it or right. riding a bike on it or right. whatever. So they disturb wildlife. So there's a lot of impacts on the ecosystem that they say they're trying to improve the health of. And then the other, so getting back to the other excuse, which is fire prevention spread, as I mentioned, there are always exceptions that people will point to saying that, thinning reduced fire spread. But you'll often find, if you look at the studies, that there's qualifiers. there was a thing that came out recently in Frontiers of Ecology or something. Anyway, there's a woman named Susan Pritchard who did some study over in Washington State saying that thinning seemed to slow fires. But if you read her paper, it seemed to slow it on the south facing slopes, but not the north facing slopes or the north facing slopes. In fact, I forget now which one. But in other words, it only had an effect on some areas. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was south facing slopes, which are generally thinner to begin with, anyhow. Right. So I don't know. I remember another study that was done on grazing. You know, you hear if we only grazed it more, we wouldn't have much fires. I mean, the Bridger Fire burned through all these hay fields and pastures with 1-inch stubble right out here, you know? And you're telling me that's hardly any fuel. And you think that's, you know,
right.
Is a solution? But anyway, there was one study that was done by down in Arizona State, and it was all modeling too, which I'm always suspect of modeling. But anyway, at the very end of the last paragraph, or next to the last paragraph, they say, their conclusion was that grazing helped to reduce fire spread. But they said, but this only applies under low to moderate fire conditions, not extreme. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, all the big fires are burning under extreme fire conditions. So just because something might work under lesser mm-hmm. conditions, the lesser conditions you don't have to worry about.
Right.
And here's my analogy that I've come up with. I looked up to see how many earthquakes there are in California annually. It's about 10,000. And the vast majority of them are like between 1 and 3 on the Richter scale. And every once in a while, you have one that's 6 or 7, and bridges come down and buildings tumble and people get killed. And it may be 1 in 100,000 earthquakes that are a 7. Mm-hmm. So if you were trying to claim that modifications of buildings, you know, to withstand earthquakes, and you're using as your sample the 1 and 2 and 3 on the Richter scale, you know, that is just meaningless, because 1 and 2 and 3 don't do any damage really anyway. And it's the 7 or the 8s or whatever that bridges come down, and there's not much that they've so far done that retrofitting that, that works under those conditions. And that's sort of the same thing. Maybe 1 in 100,000 fires gets to be big, but it's burning under those extreme conditions when nothing works.
Just want to take a moment to remind listeners, you are tuned in to KGVM 95.9 FM in Bozeman, serving Southwest Montana, and streaming online at kgvm.org. We're talking with George Werthner about fire ecology today. Wanted to ask, we're seeing a big spike in lumber prices this year in most of the country. There's a building boom in Montana. Do we need some of the wood from public lands to fulfill our building needs and paper needs and others? I mean, we, you know, we talk about this in kind of an abstract, but obviously we all are using wood products. How does that...
Well, I have two answers to respond to that. First of all, most of our wood comes from the southeast, where trees grow fast. And we're seeing, like, a mill just closed in St. Regis, even though there's this high demand, because it costs way more to log in the Rocky Mountains. Because you have to build roads on mountainsides. In Georgia or Mississippi, it's flat. The trees grow to cutting size in 10 to 15 years, as opposed to 50 or 60 years, even around St. Regis, which is kind of wet. So the first answer is that I haven't looked up recently, but it used to be that only about 3 to 4% of our lumber came off of public lands. It may be even less now, I don't know. In other words, in the big scheme of things, it doesn't contribute that much. And the second thing is that there are many other things we could be building with, which is a point of, you know, when people say, oh, we need wood, and I agree we do use some wood, but there's a lot of building materials that you could build with that don't require as much wood or would be just as cheap. For example, it sounds surprising, but there's a trend towards building with metal. For studs and so forth. And most of that metal is recycled. Mm-hmm. So it's you know, there's an energy cost to melt it down and reform it again and so forth. But it's not going out and getting new, you know, it's not like they're digging up new iron or something to make those studs in many cases. So that, or hay bales used in house construction, or soil, packed soil. There are all sorts of things that could be used to form a lot of the walls of homes that, in fact, have other advantages. I had a friend that made a packed earth house down in Colorado that I visited, and it was 10 degrees. It was January, 10 degrees at night, and it was 65 inside the house with no heat on because the walls are 3 feet thick. Mm-hmm. And in the same token, in the summertime, it never got very hot in his house either. And it was, there was a lot of dirt around his house to use for construction. In other words,
right.
It's a pretty common commodity out there. So I had a friend that was an architect who was an advocate of straw bale houses. And he had a problem with people getting loans from banks to build straw bale houses. I don't know if it's still that way, but... the banks wouldn't loan on them. So there's sort of an institutional bias against some of these other construction methods. And so that's a problem. And then, you know, the other thing, I don't want to be a party pooper, but maybe we could build smaller houses too. And so, you know, there's a lot of 4,000 square foot houses being built around here that people could probably live comfortably in a 2,000 square foot house, for example, and use mm-hmm. half the wood.
I don't know if anything that small is being built in Big Sky even.
Yeah, right.
4,000 right. square feet, you see.
Yes.
You see 10,000 and greater.
Possibly, yes.
Coming up there.
So anyway, the point of it is there's all these institutional biases towards mm-hmm. wood just because we've been doing it that way for a long time. I remember doing a trip to Europe and going around, traveling around. I was giving talks about national parks in the United States. And one of my hosts was showing me around, and a lot of the houses where he lived were built out of stone or cinder block. But But the inside was just beautiful wood, you know, trimming and so forth. And I noted to him, I said, a lot of the houses here are built with stone and sandblock. He said, oh, wood is too valuable to waste just in a wall. We like it where we can see it, but we don't build the main part of the wall. And I thought, you know, that's an interesting perspective. And in Germany, of course, they don't have the land base to waste trees on something like a wall. And so they build with other things, and it works.
So talking about the building part of the equation, here in Montana, you know, zoning regulations are often seen as a communist plot in some people's eyes. And, you know, what you see going on, I mentioned Big Sky, just uncontrolled development really at the forest kind of human interface. Right. What are some examples from other places that we might look to if we were to take seriously the idea that we need to look at that part of the equation of minimizing the potential destruction of fires in communities and keeping communities more compact, less encroachment into the most fire-sensitive zones? What could you offer up as examples?
That's another great question. You got a lot of good questions. So there's two things I'm going to mention about that. I was noticing as I travel around even Montana and the rest of the West, a lot of the early downtown sections of towns like Livingston or Bozeman are not built near the forest. And that was because in the old days they couldn't stop fires.
Right.
And they had to be where it was low fuel, and then they usually had horses grazing and pastures and stuff like that that also added a little bit of help. And most of the buildings were made out of brick because they were less likely to burn as well. And now we expand into what they call the wildlands urban interface is very common and around the West. And one of the things that are, there's a couple of things happening. One, in California anyway, friends of mine tell me that it's becoming harder and harder to get insurance on their homes because of the risk of fire. Or if they do get it, they have to pay really high premiums, which I think is only fair. And a second thing that I would mention is that Oregon, of all the Western states, has statewide zoning. And every town, a town the size of Clyde Park, will have planning about where the growth is going to happen. And so what they do is every 20 years, they analyze where they project the population will go, where they think is the best place to have any growth in that community, and they can direct it. And there's a lot of benefits to it besides just fire. You know in advance there's going to be 1,000 new houses here, so you can build highways and roads that can deal with that traffic. You can put in sidewalks in advance and bike paths, you know, before it gets all built up. And you can't put those things in readily. You can say, we're going to need a new elementary school in this neighborhood because we're going to have 1,000 families living here or whatever. So there's all sorts of additional benefits to the planning. And by the way, to those that are hostile to that idea, the planning is not set in stone. So, for example, if your community were to grow faster than anticipated, you can revise the plan in less than 20 years and add to that to what's going to happen. So, for example, Bend, Oregon, where I live part of the time, has just completed its growth plan. And it added, I believe it was 4,000 acres to the urban growth boundary of the town. And they're planning on accommodating 25,000 more people with just 4,000 acres. And what you see there, and it's become increasingly obvious in towns in Oregon, is a very abrupt edge between the town and sort of the farmland or forest land or whatever around the state. Now, they had the grandfather, and that was passed in 1972 by a Republican legislature and a Republican governor. So there, it's not, you know, at least in those days, the Republicans weren't against all this stuff. They had the grandfather in already subdivided land. So you won't see absolute, you know, here's the border of a town and there's not a house beyond there. But it's pretty thin in a lot of places. And I remember I went to grad school for a while at the University of Oregon in Eugene. And sometimes I'd drive at night from Portland down the Willamette Valley where 70% of the people in Oregon live. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting. You'd be in lights And then it gets dark for 10 or 15 miles. Then you hit the next town and it's lights. And then it gets dark again. And there really wasn't a lot of growth outside of those urban growth boundaries. And you can set aside things like the prime farmland, you know, no growth in unless it's right next to an existing part of town. So there are other things that happen.
So you mentioned the fact that these laws in Oregon were put into place by a Republican legislature and governor. Mm-hmm. Seems like having that kind of planned growth is absolutely going to result in a lower tax burden on citizens in the community. By having the development planned, you're going to be able to plan public infrastructure, maximize its efficiency, rather than having, you know, cul-de-sacs wherever the developers want them to go. And is that something that can be used as a tool to kind of change the mindset of folks in Montana and other places with a much more laissez-faire attitude that, hey, this makes good economic sense as well as being good for wildlife or
There are, of course, studies that show exactly what you're saying, that providing services to, you know, school buses or ambulance or police or sheriff, whatever, to places just hidden up in the woods, not to mention what we spend on fire, too, it is much higher as a result. The problem is I don't know how many of those people would believe the studies, but they are out there.
Oh, yeah.
And they demonstrate that that fact. The other thing with the interesting thing, when this was first passed, it actually had the support of a lot of farmers and ranchers at the time. And one of the benefits of that has been, now, not all of these want, because some guys want to just subdivide and cash in.
Right.
But if you're a farmer there in Oregon and you want to expand your business, you can buy the farm next to you if it's for sale, because it has no value for subdivision. So its value is its agricultural production value. Mm-hmm. So when I lived in Eugene, I lived next to, right on the edge of town, but there was a guy who had a 10-acre farm there. And he grew flowers and other vegetables, you know, kind of a small farm kind of a situation. But he was able to, I don't want to say it's derogatory, but he was like 42-year-old hippie who didn't have much money. But he was able to buy this 10 acres because it was just only good for farming. And even though it was right on the edge of Eugene, but it was outside the urban growth boundary, so he was able to pick it up very inexpensively and make a living farming.
So having those kind of regulations in place is also likely to be a way to keep more small farms and ranches that otherwise would be priced out by, or at least enticed to sell out to real estate development.
That's exactly it. And so there's that benefit to those who are interested in that, you know, keeping it in agriculture, and especially the smaller farms, which are the ones most likely to sell out, you know.
So, George, what are some of the steps that you would like to see taken when it comes to specifically to forest fires and ecology that would help better protect our resources, more efficiently use public resources, and have overall positive impacts? What are some of the things people should be thinking about supporting?
If I were king,
we'll make you king for a day.
What I would do is take a lot of the money that they're using for doing this thinning and other activities like that, the active forest management, and I would focus it on hardening communities and homes. What I mean by that is, you know, there are a lot of people that built a house 25 years ago with cedar shake roof, for example, which is going to burn down if a fire ever comes near, but they don't have the money to put in a new roof. You could do some thinning and burning right around a community, but it has to be done really frequently. Up in Canada, I visited the town that's right on the edge of Banff there, has instituted burning annually in the forest, right on the edge of town. Well, that costs a lot of money because it's, you know, you got to be careful how you do it and so forth. So they've spent their money, and they've had two forest fires come through in that time, and the town has survived it, in part because they implemented those things right on the edge of town. In terms of other things, I would discourage building in the wildlands urban interface, and that is happening more and more, but it's not a regulation. You know, one of the problems, this is a little thing that people don't realize, but a lot of the wildfires start because of down power lines. So you have so every time you put a house out there in the woods and you've got power lines going to it,
right,
you've got the setup for a major disaster. Last year, there was some big fires in the Western Cascades on Labor Day, actually. 13 of those fires were started by power lines, where a tree had fallen on a power line and ignited a fire. Paradise, California, that burned up in the campfire, was a power line failure. So that would be another thing. You could take money. First of all, you could try not to build in this place. But even if you did, you would require that power lines be buried. That would do that would have a big effect on fire ignitions. You could have basically higher insurance rates go to people that are choosing to build in those areas, especially new construction.
Does the private insurance market not take that into account, adequately?
I was at I'm a member of the Association for Fire Ecologists, and they have an annual meeting every year. But one of them, they had a geographer there who worked for the insurance companies. And what he said was, don't count on insurance rates to be the big factor. Because he said, in terms of the insurance companies, the losses from fire were relatively small in most cases. Now, the campfire did 19,000 structures and homes, so that's sort of the exception. But like the Dixie Fire that's burned almost 1 million acres so far, it's only burned down 600 structures in almost 1 million acres. So to the insurance company, that's a reasonable loss compared to the things they're dealing with, like a Katrina that, you know, wrecks whole cities.
But isn't
cities.
There an incentive for them still to place higher rates on those houses that are in that?
They are starting to in places by zip codes. But then you have politicians coming in and saying, well, you know, it's not because people complain then. And this is not fair that, you know, my insurance rates are going up so high. And in some places, they're making it illegal for the insurance companies to raise them very much. So you have that problem. Or you have the problem that anytime houses burn down, oh, it's a disaster, and we give all sorts of money to rebuild in those places. Building in the floodplain of a river over and over again.
Right. So you mentioned Katrina, and I know one of the reforms being pushed is, rather than federal funds being used to give people money to rebuild in a place that's likely to be, you know, flooded again, they're giving them money on the condition that they relocate rather than rebuild in that spot. Is there anything similar being done?
Not that I'm aware of, but that would be one way to deal with that. People are rebuilding. I've been to Paradise a couple of times since it burned down, and here's some interesting things that people don't know as a rule. Well, two things, three things. One, I was shocked when I went there. I always used to say, I used to give these talks, and I always have a picture of a Walmart parking lot. And I said, well, everything will burn except for a Walmart parking lot. Well, in Paradise, the Walmart and the Safeway burned down. so that wasn't even true anymore. But the other thing that people weren't aware of is that after a fire of homes, you have all these toxic metals on the site. And, forest fire, you don't get that. So you have to clean up these sites, which is very expensive, to get rid of all the toxic materials on the site before you can rebuild. And also, their water supply got toxic metals in it. So I don't know if they fixed it yet, but they were predicting it was going to take 3 or 4 years to get the water system working again in Paradise. So people are going and building back there, and it's one of the fires... I don't know if it was a Dixie Fire. I think it was a Dixie Fire. Was there or some other fire close by that was coming back towards Paradise, even this summer, you know? And the interesting thing, if you go to Paradise, and I've seen this a whole lot, I got pictures like this from all over the West, where the houses are burned to the ground and there's green trees all around. The explanation for that is burning embers landing on houses. And the thing that people don't realize, too, is that a house fire puts out way more heat than a forest fire. And a forest fire, even an extreme fire, is like a heat pulse that comes through. And if that house doesn't catch on fire immediately, it won't. And that's why treating the houses, putting in metal roofs, and putting in, for example, thermal pane windows. One of the entryways of fires is the windows give out and the embers get in there. And even little things you wouldn't think about, like doggy doors. I mean, doggy doors are made to swing open in the wind, right? And so you got a 50-mile-an-hour wind that's blowing embers in your house.
Right.
So there are things you can do that are pretty simple that will make your house less likely to burn. And here's the key. This is, again, the anti-regulation folks won't like. But if I do all those nice things to my house and you don't, your house catches on fire, my house is probably going to burn down because your house is throwing out so much heat. So you see this whole, like, domino effect where whole neighborhoods burn down because one house caught on fire. So it has to be a regulation that everybody has to have. Now, there's another point I just saw. I was looking at pictures this morning of South Lake Tahoe, where they're doing evacuation, and it's just there was a traffic jam, you know, miles long, because they haven't thought about how you're going to get away. And the same thing happened in Paradise. There was only two roads out. A lot of communities have to start thinking about, if you suddenly had to get 30,000 people out of here in a couple of hours,
right,
how are you going to do that? And can you do that? And the same thing with even neighborhoods being built. I testified against a subdivision that was happening in Bend, Oregon, to the land use board that approves or doesn't approve subdivisions. And one of the things I was arguing was right next to the National Forest, and there was only one road in and out. Well, they actually denied it, the subdivision. And then the county commissioners, who never saw a building thing that they didn't like, overruled the
right.
the ruling, and the subdivision did get built. However, they were required to put in two more exits, for example,
mm-hmm.
and they had to, everybody had to have metal roofs or non-flammable roof. So they put measures
right.
that at least makes it better for that situation.
Very good.
Yeah.
Well, George, our hour together has flown by.
Okay.
I wanted to just offer you a quick moment since you've authored more than 30 different books on a wide range of topics. What are some of the other things that you've been writing about, and what's your latest folks might be interested in knowing about?
This whole thing is being driven by climate change, and we have to really take it serious and start dealing with it. We're going to have these hot summers, we're going to have more high winds, fires, all that. So if you want, you know, it's a long-term thing. We're not going to stop this overnight, but we can start to reverse it. And one of the things that people may not realize that they can do individually is, you know, livestock is one of the main sources of methane that's contributing to climate change. So the food you choose to eat, I call it, you know, fighting climate change with a fork. Eat less red meat. Eat more vegetables. You know, you can research it. I'm not going to tell everybody what thing is, and I'm not even going to tell you don't eat a hamburger if you really want to, but maybe eat a little less,
mm-hmm.
and that makes a difference. And it's something that everybody individually can do that will greatly improve the global situation for CO2 releases. And the other thing I would say is, the other thing I'm really interested in, we need a lot more protected areas like wilderness and so forth. And the thing about wilderness is it's where we actually accept self-limitations. And we need a whole lot more self-restraint in our society. And everybody I know chafes at it. I chafe at certain regulations myself.
Mm-hmm.
But still, for the collective good of ourselves and the planet and everything else on the planet, we have to start realizing that self-restraint is it's a very positive thing. I don't know why conservatives don't like it, because they're always talking about it. But self-restraint in terms of developing land and our wild places are essential for a lot of species to survive, and they happen to be good carbon storage places and so forth. So I would say more wilderness and parks.
Very good. Thank you, George.
Okay.
All right. So thanks again to our guest, George Werthner. You can see more of his writing online at Counterpunch and Wildlife News, and you can find his books at your favorite local independent bookstore, including just a few blocks away from us at the Country Bookshelf in Bozeman. You've been listening to The View From Here, 95.9 FM Bozeman, KGVM Radio. Also, if you just caught part of the show and want to hear the full thing, it'll be online streaming at kgvm.org. Thanks again for joining us today, George.
Well, thanks for having me.